of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. Our guest today is Jason Zeidenberg. He is the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Justice Policy Institute. But first, I want to thank you. This is the four-year anniversary of the Drug Truth Network, and I want to thank the good folks at KPFT and to all the affiliates out there along the lines, including our newest KASF in Alamosa, Colorado. Okay, so now let's jump into the show. Here's an interview I recorded with Jason Zeidenberg. Well, each week we dig a little deeper into this cesspool that they call a justice system here in the U.S., and this week I'm proud to have with us Mr. Jason Zeidenberg. He's the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Justice Policy Institute. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you for having me on.
Jason, tell us a bit about your organization, please.
The organization, the Justice Policy Institute, does research and communications work around promoting alternatives and looking at ways to end society's reliance on incarceration in the United States.
You guys, you have your eyes wide open. You see this problem. Tell us a bit about the work you're doing these days.
The biggest thing that we do as it impacts drug offenders and people that may or may not have a drug problem or people perceived by the justice system to have a drug problem is try to promote what's the best way to deal with people's issues. And we believe that there are people in this country for whom certain drugs are a problem for them in terms of some aspect of their life, and that problem doesn't need to be dealt with through the justice system. We also do believe that our response to drug policy shouldn't be done through the justice system. It could be done through the public health system, through the mental health system, through the education system, and that we're just investing too much money incarcerating people for too long for drug offenses. The organization has written about 10 publications that have looked at the impact of the overuse of incarceration on drug offenders, and several papers that have looked at what could communities do to reduce the number of people incarcerated for drug offenses.
The truth be told, if we didn't send so many of our young people to treatment for marijuana addiction, so to speak, we'd have beds open.
Yeah, that's a very complicated issue. JPI does not take a position on terms of whether we should legalize marijuana and what we should do with people that use marijuana. And I personally am kind of agnostic on it. It's certainly not the drug we should be focusing on in terms of what impact it has on communities. And the contrast that I've been trying to make around what we're doing in this country around marijuana is this. According to a Harvard University academic who studied the issue, we spend about $5 billion in this country on criminal justice responses to marijuana. That's police, prisons, and the justice system. We spend $16 million on new treatment for methamphetamines, which everyone says is the big new drug problem in the United States. Now, I don't even know if that's true, but I do know that there's probably a greater need for drug treatment for methamphetamine than $16 million worth of treatment versus $5 billion of criminal justice spending on marijuana. The other thing I would say about marijuana is we have looked at whether or not arresting people for marijuana has any impact on use. And basically, marijuana use rates rise and fall at their own measure and have nothing to do with the number of people that we arrest or incarcerate for marijuana offenses.
Well, Jason, there's a large disparity in the mechanism of this justice system. I know that in New York State, 94% of those in prison for drug offenses are black or Hispanic. And as our good friend from LEAP says, if you can't see the racism, you must have a sheet over your head. Now, your thoughts, sir.
Yeah, I think that what what we do around drug policy and how that impacts African-Americans versus whites says a lot about the functioning of the justice system overall. The presumption out there is that if we see overrepresentation in the prison system, that 94% of the people in prison are African-American who are there for drug offenses, that somehow they disproportionately use drugs or sell drugs. And that isn't the case. We have other indicators like the National Household Survey, like Monitoring the Future Survey, that show that African-Americans use drugs at either less or the same rates as whites. So the idea that somehow just looking at the prison system or looking at drug arrests, the African-American community is more engaged in drug use than whites, just simply isn't true. There's many things that we do through the justice system, particularly in arrest patterns, that influence the way that our prison populations work. And many people have said, smarter than me, that if we were arresting people in their living rooms and not on street corners, we would have a very different looking prison system with respect to drug offenders. So for us, it's an issue of social justice and an issue of how resources are deployed. And whether or not you call it racism or you call it institutionalized racism, there's clearly racial disparity in terms of drug use in this country, drug sales in this country, and who ends up behind bars for drug offenses in this country.
Just a quick aside, a few years back in USA Today, Wisconsin, which has about 2% black population, had 44% of the drug prisoners. You know, it's absolutely broken.
Yeah.
What are some points you'd like to relay?
Well, first thing is, with all the controversy around what William Bennett said last week about you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down, you know, I think what we see in terms of the racial disparity in drug arrests versus drug use really answers that pretty definitively, that no, there really is no disproportionate engagement of the African-American community in crime. We see some disparity in terms of arrests, but that's not the same as measuring all the crime that happens in the United States, including corporate crime. So I think the sad thing about drug offenders is that it's a growing part of the prison population. It's about a quarter of the prison population. But in many ways, it tells us the most about what's wrong with the overall justice system. The other thing that I would say to people working on drug policy reform is don't forget the impact that the war on drugs has on all other offenses. I think we spend a lot of time talking about the 400,000, 500,000 people incarcerated on a drug offense. Many of the people who are in there for more serious offenses are there because the way that the drug trade is structured or the way the war on drugs has structured the drug trade causes more harm in our communities than needs to be. If we invested in a good treatment infrastructure in this country, we wouldn't be seeing the kind of crime that we see in our communities, and we wouldn't be seeing the harm that happens in our communities. So I think overall what we need to do is reinvest the money that we're spending on drug offenders, incarcerating them and arresting them, and put it into a treatment infrastructure that can meet the needs of the people that have needs to be met.
Well, I see these reports. U.S. crime rate is falling, falling, and yet the number of drug prisoners is growing. These are nonviolent people, yet the violent crime rate is falling. What's going on there, Jason?
There's no relationship between the number of people you arrest, the number of people you imprison, and the crime rate. There's been all sorts of very thorough pieces of research, including some sponsored by the Justice Department, that show at best, a quarter of all the violent crimes that didn't happen in the 1990s related to the expansion of prison. So that's about 75% of the crime rate drop that had nothing to do with prison expansion. It had to do with the economy. It had to do with healthier communities. It may have had something to do with community policing strategies. It may have had something to do with Big Brother syndrome, where a generation of people that were involved in the drug trade looked, you know, who went to prison, that their siblings looked up at them and thought, I don't want to be part of that life, and did not engage in the drug trade. There's about 20 different explanations for it. Very few of them have to do with locking people up. And there's another piece of this as well. We've looked at states that really increased their drug imprisonment rates versus states that did not, and there's no disproportionate impact, A, on crime, or B, on drug use.
Well, Jason, I know in a few of the states where they've been able to legitimize medical marijuana, they found that the rate of usage by their young people has remained the same or actually gone down. Your thoughts on that, sir?
It reinforces what we've said differently, which is that there's no relationship between the levels of punitiveness that we treat these drugs and drug use. We're arresting a lot of people for marijuana, but there are so many more people using it, we will never arrest our way out of marijuana use rates if you see that as a problem. And this is something I've always tried to engage people that take a different view on this, whether they're legalizers or not, is, look, we're arresting this many people are using. This isn't deterring anybody.
No, and it never will. Well, I thank you for being with us, Jason. We've been talking with Jason Zeidenberg, the executive director of the Justice Policy Institute. I urge you to visit their website, justicepolicy.org.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jason.
Take care.
This week in drug war history, September 30th, 1996, President Bill Clinton signs into law the Omnibus Consolidated Appropriations Act for 1997. Physical year 1997 totals provide increased drug-related funding for the two leading drug law enforcement agencies in the Department of Justice. October 2, 1992, 31 people from various law enforcement agencies stormed Donald Scott's 200-acre ranch in Malibu, California, looking for marijuana plants. Scott, who believes thieves are breaking into his home, comes out of the bedroom with a gun. He is shot dead. Scott had refused earlier to negotiate a sale of his property to the government. After extensive searches, no marijuana is found. October 3, 1996, U.S. Public Law 104-237, known as the Comprehensive Methamphetamine Control Act of 1996, is signed into law by President Bill Clinton. October 4, 1970, legendary singer Janis Joplin is found dead at Hollywood's Landmark Hotel, a victim of what is concluded to be an accidental heroin overdose. October 5, 1999, the war on drugs is an absolute failure, says Governor Gary Johnson of New Mexico. Johnson also meets with founding members of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. October 6, 2000, former U.S. President Bill Clinton is quoted in Rolling Stone, "I think that most small amounts of marijuana have been decriminalized in some places and should be." This is Steve Nolan for the Drug Truth Network.
Thank you, Steve. And next up, I want to talk about some events that are going around North America, from Vancouver over to Hartford, Connecticut, back over to Seattle, San Francisco, all over the place. Cities are starting to grasp this situation, that the drug war is unwinnable, and are taking it into their own hands to make necessary changes. One of the front runners in helping in this regard from the King County Bar Association is Mr. Roger Goodman. Roger, you're involved in a lot of the ongoing discussions being held in the various cities around North America. Tell us a little bit about that work, first off.
Well, we got started here in Seattle almost 5 years ago. President of the King County Bar Association decided to speak up about it, and everybody came out of the woodwork, myself included. Since then, we've come out with a lot of policy statements and gotten the legislature, state legislature, local legislatures, like King County Council, Seattle City Council, to make some pretty progressive changes. And other municipal areas and states have taken notice. So I've been traveling around to consult with cities like Syracuse, Birmingham, Savannah, Miami-Dade, and then states too, Oregon, Hawaii, Vermont, Wisconsin, Kentucky. We're going all over the place. Too much work to handle, actually.
Well, I hear you, and you're also scheduled to be part of an event this later this month up in Hartford, being put on by Aetna Insurance.
That's going to be a major event. Really, the city leaders of Hartford recognize that this is sort of a, it might be a vigilant fight, but it doesn't, we don't seem to be making any improvement, this war on drugs approach. And so for the city leaders and opinion leaders and elected leaders to be hosting this thing is really a watershed. It's only one of a number of conferences, however. I mean, this is a revolutionary period, if you think about it. In Vancouver, just a few days before Hartford, is going to be a major conference, international conference on beyond prohibition, just talking about it right up front. How do we put a regulatory system together beyond drug prohibition? Then the Hartford Conference, and then the major biennial drug policy conference in Long Beach soon after that. And then here in Seattle, we're putting on a conference called Exit Strategy for the War on Drugs, New Legal Framework. So we're talking about it, too, out in the open with public officials and civic and professional leaders attending and the media paying attention. So it's a very exciting time.
Well, this also follows on the heels of the methamphetamine conference in Salt Lake City. And it also precedes the American Public Health Association's event in December. Roger, the fact is that the newspapers are not giving it bold headlines. They're not shouting it from the rooftops, but change is indeed taking place, is it not?
Yeah, that's okay. We don't need banner headlines. That's saved for Supreme Court nominees and the war in Iraq. I think the culture change here is sort of person to person and organization by organization. And sure, there's a lot of good coverage, too. But really, we're basically selling an idea that makes sense. And by selling the idea, we get people to talk about it, the conversation, the language changes, and that changes the culture, and then the laws change with that. So it's sort of a process rather than trying to get a big splash with some headline.
Well, with alcohol prohibition, it was the push, if you will, from the local organizations, from the state governments, that finally brought it to an end.
Well, the one question I've been getting over and over again is, well, what about that Supreme Court decision? I mean, it doesn't matter what the states do. The federal government can overrule it. And I said, no, the state laws are still very much intact, and states can do whatever they want for public health, public safety. If the federal government wants to use its resources to go into the state's business, they are free to do that. But that doesn't necessarily mean the states don't have the flexibility, as in alcohol prohibition, not to enforce the federal law. The state of New York, most of New England, from pretty much the beginning, didn't appropriate any funds, didn't allow their agents to participate with federal agents, didn't even, Rhode Island and Connecticut, I think, didn't even ratify the 18th Amendment. So states have a lot of discretion and a lot of flexibility and police power. So that's one question that's been coming up over and over again. And that's what this culture change is about, that the laws follow the change in understanding, and the laws will happen on the state level to the point where Congress, then, representing or understanding the national sentiment, will do something, in fact, very simple. All Congress has to do is amend the Controlled Substances Act, the current federal law, to allow states to do this. Right now, federal law preempts if there's any conflict. And so you have to just change one section of one law, and then we could have this experimentation, which would, I think, yield better results. That's what we're fighting for.
I'll be reporting from a few of these conferences. The next is October 21st in Hartford, Connecticut. And if you'd like to learn more about that event, I urge you to visit our good friend Cliff Thornton's website, efficacy-online.org. Identify this jurisdiction by its outrageously punitive laws. This government convicts and kills more people than any civilized nation. Because of their drug war policies, they send more people to prison than any other jurisdiction on planet Earth. And they remain to this day proud of their efforts. There's no breaking the traditions in Texas.
Hello, Drug Truth Network listeners. This is Nora Callahan with the November Coalition. And today we're readying for a weekend workshop and conference here. People and mostly leaders of other community groups from all over the state and some national groups are coming to our house here in Colville, Washington, And we're very excited because what we're doing is forming a strong alliance of rural and urban people to have honest discussions about our drug laws, to have honest discussions about drugs. And that's launching this weekend, and we're really excited. And we're having harm reduction workshop, medical marijuana. And in the early session, we will be discussing the history of Washington state drug laws. And what a lot of people don't realize is that the sentencing scheme that the federal government have in place for drug laws began in Washington state, and this year is the 20th anniversary of those laws. And of federal importance is the federal parole bill has picked up some more sponsorship from the members of the Black Caucus. And there's also been fiscal conservatives in Congress are looking at the drug war and ways that our budget crisis could be eased by disappearing some of the drug laws that particularly have been offensive to people, have resulted in even criminal indictments. And one is the ONDCP's ad campaign, and a second is the high-intensity drug trafficking areas. So we're seeing that we can no longer afford the injustice. Please visit us on the World Wide Web at november.org for daily updates, breaking news, and to follow along with many leaders across the country who are working to end drug war injustice.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
The Bush administration has an Afghan tiger by the tail. Earlier this year, the U.S. State Department warned that Afghanistan's illicit opium production can be viewed as the rough equivalent of world illicit heroin production. This week in Congress, a bipartisan effort was launched by Democrat Dana Rohrabacher and Republican Dan Burton to expedite controversial mycoherbicide research and sow the Afghan poppy fields with poppy-killing fungal spores. Frustrated by the administration's blind-eye policy, both congressmen called for the wholesale eradication of the Afghan opium poppy. Recently, Afghanistan held its first parliamentary election in a generation. Although official results are not yet in, the election website shows that in most provinces, the top-ranking candidates are warlords or leaders of Mujahideen factions. Last week, the editor-in-chief of an Afghan woman's magazine was arrested by Afghan authorities on charges of blasphemy. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
You know, in many ways, Canada is much more civilized than the United States, but a lot of folks tend to think that they aren't having their problems with drugs up there, even particularly marijuana. But nothing could be further from the truth. Here's a report I did with Matt Elrod.
I'm Matthew Elrod. I'm the webmaster of DrugSense and the Media Awareness Project. I'm located in Victoria, B.C., the capital of British Columbia, on Vancouver Island.
Matt, I hear there's talk that the Canadians now may handle the trial of Mark Emery. What's going on with that situation?
Well, it's my understanding that an activist, a legal activist, who up until now has not been involved in drug policy, has filed charges against Mark Emery and Greg and Michelle as the co-defendants, charges of conspiracy to traffic in cannabis seeds. Its intent, I think, is to get a charge against Emery on the Canadian books so that to basically intervene into the extradition process and say, well, look, before you extradite this guy, he needs to face justice in Canada first. And as you might expect, Mark's reaction is actually receptive to the idea, which is a little weird, that, you know, he would welcome somebody filing charges against him, but that's the Stello's strategy.
Matt, what's going on with the decrim bill? Is it making any progress? Well, I hear the families of the four slain RCMP officers want more draconian laws, much like the U.S. What's your take?
That's quite right, and the last word to come out of Ottawa was that our Justice Minister, Erwin Kotler, has permanently shelved the Liberal decriminalization bill as a consequence of those families putting pressure on the Liberal government to scrap it. Now, certainly pressure from the United States also played a role The Liberal government was already very nervous about that bill and had pretty much sidelined it. But I think the final nail in the coffin was pressure from these families who, of course, get a very sympathetic ear. They all lost family members, you know. I think they bear some responsibility for those deaths, for putting four officers on that property when they knew the fellow they were looking for in Mayor Thorpe, Alberta, was armed, dangerous, maybe a little crazy and unaccounted for. You know, my own interpretation is that those families are being exploited in a very distasteful way. The reformer reaction is twofold. One group of reformers is saying, well, it wouldn't have happened if cannabis were legal. That is to say, the police wouldn't have been there, and this is a consequence of prohibition. Unfortunately, I don't agree with that interpretation. The police were actually there investigating this fellow for not making payments on his truck, and they also discovered stolen property, auto parts, at his farm, and were investigating that. So the whole issue really had very little, if anything, to do with cannabis or grow ops or anything like that. But it's being used by the bad guys in that way.
I've heard it said that it would diminish the stature of the magnitude of Texas and Alaska, but the addition of Canada as a 51st state might not be such a bad idea.
Well, I guess it would add to the weight of the blue states. You know, I recall after the last election, somebody circulated a picture on the internet of a redivided North America, divided into New Canada, including the blue states, and Jesus Land. But to be honest, I think I wouldn't like that. I would rather we remain an independent, as much as we are an independent country from the United States. I think that the reason that Mark Emery was arrested, you know, was almost entirely political. And the reason that the U.S. put so much pressure on us not to liberalize our drug laws in any way whatsoever, and, you know, they rail against our injection site in Vancouver, and they complain about our heroin maintenance trials in Vancouver, etc., is not that they're worried about drugs flowing over the border. They're worried about progressive thinking flowing over the border, and they're worried about us providing an example, a real working example of how a drug policy can work.
A lot of what I do is designed to help you. You know that. You and your kids, generations of your kids, the future and stability of this nation. And I want you to be able to look back in 5, 10, or 20 years, however long it takes to end this madness of drug war, and to be able to tell your great-grandkids what you did, what part you played in ending this grand charade of drug prohibition. What will it take to motivate? All right, my friends, we're about done here. And once again, I want to remind you, go to the new website. Learn more, educate yourself, and become a spokesman to power. And that's at endprohibition.org. Once again, I remind you, there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data, no moral clarity, no religious underpinnings, in fact, no reason whatsoever for the drug war to continue another second. We've been duped. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. I ask you to please do your part to help bring it to an end. Prohibido esta aquí Velasco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.